Okay, I'm going to introduce our speaker. Gary Jordan is retired healthcare industry executive, consultant, and business owner, a native of Athens, Georgia, and graduate of the University of Georgia. Upon graduating from UGA, he started his business career with Johnson & Johnson and was employed by several other well-known multinational healthcare industry companies over the next 30 years, Bayer, Smith & Nephew, and St. Jude Medical, now part of Abbott Labs. He finished his mainstream big corporate career with Johnson & Johnson, serving as president of its Cordis subsidiary with revenue responsibility of approximately $1 billion and over 2,000 full-time employees. In late 2000, Gary and his wife Connie returned to Georgia, settled in Polo Golf and Country Club, and Gary started his non-traditional entrepreneurial second and third careers. Over the next 5 years, he was part of an executive team leading a startup in laser vision correction from pre-IPO through IPO stages. He also served as president of a turnaround company focused on marketing and development of innovative vascular products and contract manufacturing for other healthcare industry companies. After that company was acquired in 2004 by a venture capital firm, Gary established his consulting company focused on the healthcare industry. His clients include global 50 companies, startups, and investors generally interested in implantable devices and breakthrough technologies. Most recently, he also established a company to represent a next-generation gene sequencing laboratory, providing tests for predictive assessment of cancer risks and preconception testing for hereditary career diseases, such as catastrophic diseases, such as sickle cell, muscular and atrophy, and many others. Since late November of 2016, Gary's also served as the community as president of the Polo Golf and Country Club Homeowners Association. And it's always great to get a detailed bio like this. Gary did a great job of doing that, and it's great to have him talk today both about his life journey and what he's learned, and then also some time on the Polo Homeowners Association initiative. Please welcome Gary Jordan.
Okay. Yeah, when Hines was talking about dropping cards for any of those that are running for office, I was thinking about the old story of who are you running from rather than what are you running for. So I don't fall into that category today, but maybe there were a couple times in my life when I did fall into that category. Fairly extensive discussion of my background already. I think maybe a starting point for me today is to say, when Hines invited me to speak the first time, because we had to reschedule, I sort of scratched my head saying, okay, you know, what can I really take to an audience, you know, in the way of life achievements, et cetera. And the second time when we rescheduled, I sort of went through the same process. I was thinking, well, let's see. Let me think back on some of the prior speakers. You've got a sports broadcaster. You've got a high achieving professional athletes, collegiate athletes in the past. Most recently, you had an individual that has an illustrious military career, well-decorated war hero, actually born on a table in a European small village. I'm thinking, well, I was born in Athens, Georgia, at Athens General Hospital. Now, how do I equate that to, you know, being really interesting? And I challenged my wife. I said, you know, Connie, why do you think Hines invited me to do this? And her comment, typically in keeping me humble, was, well, I guess all the interesting guys were busy that Saturday. So that's sort of how I've come into this. I don't know that I can add an awful lot. I'll try to be a little bit entertaining as we go through this and keep it away from being a repetition of what Hines has already given you. I grew up in the Athens, Georgia area. A friend of mine says you use that because everyone recognizes Athens, Clark County. They don't recognize the map dot where we grew up, and that's true. I grew up in Danielsville, Georgia, grand population of 210 people when I was born there. As I mentioned, my dad was a plumber, blue-collar worker. My mother was a housewife. I had a very, I think, fruitful high school training experience, if you will. I reflect back on that because the county I grew up in was adjoining Athens or Clark County at that time. And the majority of the teachers, instructors in my high school and in my junior high school, although it was a fairly small school, the high school, majority of those teachers were spouses of professors at the University of Georgia, or they were pursuing PhD, master's or PhD postgraduate degrees. So we had a high bar set for us relative to the teachers that we faced in that very rural county, but it was a significant imprint on me, and I say that because I was challenged from the get-go, challenged by individual instructors in this case that had very high standards for themselves and for the students that were in the audience. And that's one of those things that I think stayed with me throughout, or has stayed with me throughout my career. Another part of this who is this guy discussion goes back to background and career path. I feel like I'm really blessed. I had the opportunity coming out of college to immediately go with a firm that was extremely large and rarely hired or recruited any individual fresh-faced out of an undergraduate program at any university at that time. In a very short order with Johnson & Johnson, I was given an opportunity to manage organizations, sales, marketing, commercial operation teams. I was actually put into a position of being able to develop training, educational programs, both for physicians as well as for our sales representatives and staff members. So along the way, early on in the first 7 to 10 years of my career, there's a lot of the teaching, if you will, either that I benefited from or that I think others benefited from through programs that we designed or I was a part of designing. So I feel very good about that. That's some of the things that if you look toward legacy when you get to my age, you say, where did you make an imprint? And that's one of the areas where I think I did make an imprint. And I'll tell you a little more about that. Area of expertise. I generally describe myself as a generalist. Although my degree is in marketing, undergraduate, that's been the mainstay for me, you know, throughout my business career. But I've been, again, given the opportunity to challenge myself outside. Technology development, leading project teams focused on implantable devices. Also being in a situation where I was given the challenge of bringing together very diverse organizations. I say that's through acquisition, growth, et cetera, particularly with St. Jude Medical. We grew from an $80 million revenue organization when I joined. Within about a six-year period, we had grown to roughly $1 billion in revenues. That was not all organic growth, but it was a combination of organic growth and acquisitions. At one time, I was responsible for an integration team that had to bring together three distinct, very different cultures into one, hopefully, functioning and effective culture in a big corporate environment. Big challenge. I sort of went back again to some of the things that were consistent in my early life. You know, over-communicating, maybe spending more time on details, really learning the issues before you put in motion a transition plan or a new organizational structure or whatever the case might be in my situation, dealing with employees that were both very gifted but also very strong-willed and obviously very high achievers. So challenges, but good challenges. You learn a lot through that stuff. My transition from mainstream big corporate that we were talking about, obviously after having a great career over roughly 30 years, with Johnson & Johnson, Bayer, St. Jude, and then recruited back to Johnson & Johnson to do what I just described, to basically bring three very dysfunctional organizations together into one highly functional and effective organization. And that was the Cordis organization. That came off an acquisition at that time, which was the largest single acquisition by Johnson & Johnson. They spent well over $1 billion to acquire that company and integrate that with a coronary stent a unit that they had. So you needed all the apparatus, all the equipment to be effective in that business. So the stents J&J had, Cordis had all the catheters, support tools, et cetera, that were necessary for success. So I was responsible on the side of cardiology to try to bring those groups together. In some respects, a Skunk Works operation versus a fairly well-functioning corporate organization is the two key. And, oh, by the way, in California, you have a business that we acquired to try to, this was Cordis, to try to make sure that no one acquired us. So we invested in a business in California in an area called electrophysiology, which is basically pacemaking and pacers. I had no idea what that was all about at that time, but I had to try to bring those three groups together. We did that. We pulled together an effective team and did that in the course of roughly a 12-month period. And since that time, it's been a fairly successful organization. So transition. I went through that. I've went through a lot of challenges. I went through a lot of success. I reached a point 30 years into my career with Johnson & Johnson, second time through, as president of a company. My next step would be to franchise chairman, and that was a big position within the J&J organization. The reality set in that I ain't going to get that position. There are others that are in a much better position than me to have that next step in their career. So that forces, in my case, forces me to step back and say, what do I want to do? 30 years in, do I want to retire? I don't necessarily want to retire. So what haven't I done that I would really like to do? I've never really done a startup. Hey, risk-taking, entrepreneurial, all the exciting buzzwords. Yeah, I didn't really appreciate the fact that you're the janitor, you're doing everything, and you move from president of a J&J company to a startup where you're everything. You're the guy that's writing the checks. You're the guy that's doing the selling of your business product service. You're cleaning up the office at night, whatever the case may be, trying to fix the printer, all of that stuff. Big transition. Was I ready for that? You know, a little bit of a challenge for me. Was I ready for that? So in late 1999, I faced the reality that I wanted a change. It was time. 30 years in big corporate, it was time to move on. So I, quote, retired. I stayed retired 9 weeks. It was a fun retirement. I was living in Florida, gated community, pool, golf course, all the things that, you know, you strive for. But, you know, sitting by the pool playing golf was not necessarily what I was enjoying. So started looking at opportunities, and that was during the time of .com. Anybody invest in .com? I did. Unfortunately, it was not a successful investment. But a friend of mine and I started working on a business plan that incorporated healthcare with the benefits of website online marketing. As it turned out, we were probably a little late to the party, put a lot of time and money into building a company, building out the concept so that we could then go to additional investors. But we missed the window, if you will. So a life lesson from that, you know, a lot of success, not my money, but a lot of success. No success, my money. So there's a big lesson learned during that process. So in 2000, late 2000, I was at a point where say, okay, real world, I'm sort of the hands-on guy. I'm a guy that really wants to get involved in some other things. Another friend through industry gave me a call and said, you know anything about laser vision correction or ophthalmology or any of those areas, those disease states? And my answer was, I wear glasses, you know, but that's about all I really know, right? So I started studying, and the end result was that I joined a team, small team, based out of Chicago for a startup, and we were transitioning a business, a physician practice management organization, over to a laser vision correction company. What that means is we had to train the physicians. We had to establish great working relationships with the Bausch & Lomb and other laser vision correction companies in that niche to try to get access to the technology as quick as possible, to try to differentiate ourselves, our company, from the mainstream companies. There was a company called TLC out of Canada. It was doing reasonably well at that time. So that was the primary competitor. But we were doing it on a more of a regional scale, Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City. Did quite well. We made for, our target was, and market model was made for, an exit after we reached a certain point. We reached that point relative to geographic scale, scope, personnel, and management team. And fortunately, we had a very nice offer from a Canadian company called TLC to acquire that business. And there I am 2 years into that entrepreneurial lifestyle saying, okay, what's next? Again, a friend, an individual that I had been a mentor of in earlier career, came to me and said, I got an opportunity I think you might be interested in. This company is being basically spun off from another larger company, and they have a manufacturing operation in Texas. I'm thinking, okay, Dallas, Houston, that's not all bad. They have like 600 employees in a manufacturing operation. They've sort of lost their way. They need guidance. They need to formulate their strategies, new business plan for technology development, yada, yada, yada. And it could be potentially a good turnaround situation, but it's going to has a lot of risk associated with it. Okay, I said, okay, where is it located? Athens, Texas. Athens, Texas. Where the heck is Athens, Texas? Athens, Texas is another map dot. So sort of getting back to my history, another map dot in basically East Texas. It's southeast of Dallas. So for almost a year and a half, I was commuting between Atlanta and Dallas and then driving to Athens, Texas, because you can't fly into Athens, Texas. So it was an interesting experience. There, I really began to deal almost single-handedly with how do you get funding for an operation to really shore up your business plan. And that's a challenge, folks. I keep coming circling back to that. But as entrepreneurs or as business people, we probably all have been faced with the fact that, you know, getting funding to chase your dreams, it's not always an easy proposition. And I found myself between the travel, everything that was going on during that time period, to sort of lose the connection with why I came back to Georgia, which was family, friends. By that time, I had a mother that had passed away, but I had been here for almost two plus years. I had a father that was in bad health. So we figured out a way, had a good potential acquirer of the business, and it was time. It was time to leave that particular phase of my life and try to refocus, at least while time was available, on family. So we had the good fortune again of being able to sell the company, and I came back. My father passed away within about 6 months, but I spent that 6 months almost totally with him. So I had that benefit, that connection, and quite frankly, reconnection with him, which was beneficial to me. Spiritually, and from an emotional vantage point, particularly good. Okay, I'm back in Atlanta. In the back of my mind all along has been consulting. You know, I've learned a lot along the way. You know, I've got some things that I could probably help some people with. Do I really want to get into that? Well, late 2003, I jumped in it full time. Again, I'm drawing upon key individuals that I've met in my career. Two individuals, an absolute master with the numbers, a financial modeling whiz, an individual that can do anything with a spreadsheet, and a market research person. Two individuals I thought would be particularly critical to what I was trying to do, which was to take a look at positioning the consultancy to provide a service to companies, investors, et cetera, that were interested in investing in new technology. One, you had to understand the technology, which I could get into reasonably well with a few other additional contacts that we came in, that I knew. But you had to be able to run the numbers, the financials, the digging into. You also had to understand, were those new technologies really viable for the consumer, the customer? In this case, it could be physician, it could be the ultimate consumer, the patient. So we had to have some of those tools available or that expertise on our staff, which we did. And then we set up basically a virtual company. 11 individuals that we can draw on from regulatory responsibility, clinical responsibility, legal understanding, proprietary law, understanding how to go through, you know, getting patents issued, et cetera. But individuals that we can draw upon as needed, not employees, but in essence consultants. Each and every one of those, either I had personal experience with from my other corporate days and trusted those individuals and understood those individuals and what they were capable of, or my other partners, the financial whiz or the market research whiz, had a similar type of relationship with those people. So we were able to draw upon the expertise we needed without, quite frankly, a great deal of investment, and we had interested parties because the majority of them had or were in their second or third career. So they were available, and they had probably better minds than your freshly minted MBAs coming out of whatever, pick a grad school. So very important there. Learn that you could do it with a lot of gray hair, and you could do it with individuals that were not, quote, employees. They were 1099 consultants and support agents for you. But you had to feed the beast. You had to make sure they had both challenging projects and they also had to have at least a certain amount of work to keep them engaged. So that was the challenge. That was my personal challenge in business development for the consultancy. So I've gone through that process, and I've been doing the consulting for quite some time. It's been good. It's been good to me. Fortune 50 companies, a lot of startups, a lot of physician founders, investors, designers that we work with. But we come up with rational plans and a rational view of what the opportunity would be for their particular product or business venture. The one thing that I've learned is that you can quickly and inappropriately overstate the opportunity in your own mind, if it's your business, or, you know, in this case, where you're dealing with other individuals, either their baby, their product, their service, et cetera, or their money. So you have to be very careful, or at least my view, you have to be very careful in consulting to balance all of that. Okay, things learned. Persistence, consistency, work ethic, I think are all key. I'm accustomed to 70-hour weeks, have been, continue to be. I'll tell you a little bit about the split now of the 70 hours between the existing businesses and HOA. But persistence, consistency, and work ethic. Some people challenge me on that, those three, saying, well, they're not appropriate any longer. And I say, you're wrong. You know, what, from my vantage point, what I see in the workplace today, there are a tremendous number of younger business people that either get that and are successful, or they don't, and they'll languish forever until they get it. Persistency pays off. You don't necessarily have to hit a home run every time, you know, but you do have to show up at the plate when it's time to bat. And a lot of folks, at least in one period of, I think, our business development in this country, got into a habit, and some still do, of not showing up. You know, they're collecting a check, but they're not showing up to really do the work. So we stress that. When we do a re-engineering in an organization, we look at individual accomplishments. We establish the right metrics for success. We understand the total available market. We understand things that really can then be used to judge performance from a factual vantage point. Not from someone's whim, or, well, I think Joe is doing a great job. Show me. How is Joe doing, or how is Jane doing against the standard? So, again, we try to make sure, and I personally feel that you have to have that accountability, both personal accountability and corporate accountability. I've mentioned a number of people that I've met along the way. Mentoring and advising from my vantage point is extremely worthwhile. There are currently 7 sitting presidents or CEOs of medical companies that I've had time to work with at some point in my career. Some of them fairly large companies. We've stayed in contact. In some cases, it's a quarterly phone just checkup, you know, to see how things are going. In some cases, I've got one individual that's basically a weekly call. You know, some question. Do I have the answers? Heck no. But at least I can help, you know, and maybe guiding that individual toward the right answers, or at least having some other straw man that I can present that say, have you considered? But that mentoring and advising has helped me many times. It's helped to feed the beast that I mentioned a moment ago, because those people oftentimes come to our consultancy for work. When they need something that they know we can deliver on, they'll come to us. So I think that's very important. I don't think we do enough of that. Quite frankly, for those that are in the demographic that I'm in, you know, let's say 65 and above, I think we can do more, still do more, in reaching out and helping people that we know, and particularly in, let's say, between 40 and 60 years of age that are still active in business. Stay connected. I've already stated that. I missed the boat, I think, a couple times with my own family. I don't think I'll ever do that again. You know, the connection is particularly critical. Friends, we've renewed relationships over the last 10 years with so many friends that we had during the 70s and 80s. It's been very beneficial in many, many ways. Stay connected with yourself. From my vantage point, that means that I was disconnected at certain points during my life as to really who I was and what I wanted. And I had to redefine myself, my goals, etc. I think that's appropriate. I used to have a friend that said, he's no longer with us, but used to say, you need to go through a maintenance check on yourself every 3 to 5 years. You need to really sit down and make sure you have your goals established. Make sure you understand, did you meet the 30,000, you know, mile service checkup or not? It's a good suggestion, you know, where we eat, you know, again, even in my demographic, where you come back to really saying, okay, what do I want to achieve over the next few years? And then, more critically, sit down with yourself and say, did I achieve it? And why not? Or why did I? The challenge of the brain, I'm 70 years old. Let's just go typical day, Friday. HOA attorneys, zoning, Forsyth County Department of Engineering. A new concept for neonatal incubators with a physician and technical people. A conference call relative to vascular, basically an ability to free up vasculature of clots. Very innovative, very different approach. And finish the day on deep brain stimulation. That's what I call challenge the brain. I mean, I find myself, if I don't challenge myself like that, or if I don't have a number of really things that I have to learn, that I end up getting bored. Now, that's me. But, again, some way I'll always challenge the brain. You know, whether it's through reading, as Don was talking about, it's through, as Don is saying, through a commitment to steering from an engineering vantage point, you know, again, an engineering vantage point, to steering the ACC along the right course when it comes to any major projects. But, you know, somehow to make sure that we're challenging the brain. Okay, let me switch gears.
One quick question.
Yes.
Any questions? You can cover separately HOA.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I'm getting ready for it.
This is up to this point. Any questions?
And hopefully I haven't bored you in any of that, but I have the set list, the script that Heinz provides, and hopefully I've touched base on most of that. Anyway.
One quick question.
Please.
What's the main thing you do to keep
the balance between your work and your family. You said that. Right?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I mean, obviously, I have two daughters. The two daughters are obviously older, and I have one grandchild, and blessed actually last year with our first grandchild. My wife would say, I don't have balance. Because I'm either engaged in something that's work related, and more recently, HOA related, primarily church, some not enough, some community activities, etc., organizations. But she would say her answer was it's not balanced. For a period of time, it was very balanced, you know. And I think for me, it's a matter of point in time. What are the issues? What am I engaged in? My wife, until recently, was a hospice case manager, and she was fully engaged in that. That had a team of people that she was working with, and that required a lot of her time. So with no kids, it would either end up being work, in my case, the HOA, or some of the other hobbies that she's involved in that I would tag along with, quite frankly. But to say that I do a good job of that now, probably not. I did a much better job when my dad was still living, or when my daughters were at a point where they were trying to make career decisions and I was helping them with that, or when they were starting their life with marriage partner. Yeah.
Gary, I would say you have to be at least 110 to do all those.
I got a lot of mileage on my body, let me put it that way.
And you ain't no Ernie Johnson. He got paid for what he did.
Yeah, yeah.
You're pretty damn good.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I'm 110, I tell you. I really do. Any other questions? I'm sorry, I didn't pause for questions there, Hunt. Any other questions or comments? HOA. I mentioned to a couple people before breakfast, it's been an interesting 8 months, 9 months or so. The current board was elected in late November of last year. And I think for us coming in, it's been a bit of a surprise at some of the things that we have to address. And that's not to throw anybody under the bus. It's just some things that, with roughly a 30-year-old neighborhood, some things that no one had really paid attention to. I mean, you do Band-Aids at best, but not really take a look at putting solutions in place for some of the needs that we have. So we started out, we really looked at what should be a basic mission statement. Again, approaching this almost like you do a business. And also this sort of served to help draft our objectives for the first year of the board. And they really came down to, you know, some key things that are underlined. Fulfilling fiduciary responsibilities that we have to all homeowners, particularly key. Protecting and enhancing the property values, again, very key. Transparency in all board decisions. There had been some good situations and bad situations relative to transparency and communications, and we felt that we had to address that. And in some respects, go beyond what was required of the board to make sure that information was transparent and available to all homeowners if they desired to take the time to either attend meetings or go on website to review materials, etc. Improved communication, just as I'm saying, we look toward use more of both meetings, newsletter, website information, e-blast, etc., to try to get more information out to the homeowners relative to decisions or in some cases, Keith and I were talking about zoning matters that really would affect the community, to keep everyone alert as to what's going on. Encouraging resident involvement and establishing goodwill. Been a little bit disappointed in this one, and we'll talk a little bit about it. The goodwill, one thing I've learned, well, actually two things I've learned since being on the board. One, you can meet an awful lot of homeowners by being on the board of directors. Between emails, text messages, phone calls, stopping you in the street, whatever, you know, you do meet a lot of people, which has been good for me. I realize how in grand total, how few of my fellow neighbors that I really knew or had really met even. So it's been good in that regard. The second, I guess, thing that I've learned is that it's it's hard to be right. Yeah, there's people get really emotional when it comes to their property or to their community. In some cases, it's hard to get them to that rational position. We've tried and we'll continue to try. There's some neighbor-on-neighbor issues in our community that bother me, but it's not an HOA. We don't control that. You know, that's something you have to say, okay, I know what's going on, but that's not mine to manage. So it's an interesting challenge being on a board. I'm not looking for empathy or sympathy or any of that. I'm just saying, for those of you that haven't done it, I encourage your involvement in committees or board going forward, but recognize it's not an easy day in the park. All right. So let's pick up on a few of those responsibilities and let me just catch you up a bit. Up from the financials, one of the things that we've tried to do is at each board meeting, and we publish on the website monthly financials, and I picked out just a few just to show you the examples of things that we're doing. And it also points out a couple of concerns. The year-to-date budget we established somewhat in a vacuum. We had some history of spend, but we did not at the time when we had to establish the budget really understand, or had we gone through a needs assessment to really know what infrastructure improvements were really needed or what capital improvements were needed. So we had to do it a little bit of, you know, the throw it against the wall and see what sticks approach, you know, utilizing history. Thus far, we've done a reasonably good job considering the fact that we've had extraordinary expenses and non-budgeted expenses that have cropped up during the first 6-7 months. Overall, the capital improvements, I'll talk a little bit about that. Overall, I think we're going to be very close to the budget when it comes year end. Some of this is more just monthly cycle, and when the bills hit or when the payments were extended or paid. Relative to the fiduciary part of this, we're now at about 1.4 million between operating cash, money market, short-term reserves, and the CD ladders, which are the long-term reserves. It's a good financial position for any homeowners association. It's a rarity that you have that much. There has been historically, and fortunately for all of us, a good commitment to maintaining reserves sufficient to handle certain crises that might arise in the community. This goes back, for those of you who have been around, which a lot of you have been around for a long time, goes back to stormwater-related issues that the Homeowners Association had to contend with. So in a good position, the change we made going to the CD ladders was to increase the use of the money or the effective rate of interest. Obviously, it's difficult to get good rate of interest anywhere, and we have to be, you know, concerned about safety of that money. But we are able to really generate more interest today than we had previously, which is good for everyone. This is an issue that hasn't changed much. The outstanding balances, this requires, you know, a lot of steps that we take, legal, collections, et cetera, to try to overcome any outstanding amounts. This is set up with the blue, if you can see that from the rear, the blue being the number of properties or homeowners that are households that are involved. And we've been reasonably consistent around 50 or so households since November that have been outstanding in some fashion. The spike in April is more just annual assessment spike, which is apparently commonplace, where, you know, people basically either because of automatic electronic bank account changes or whatever, you know, somebody may miss the due date or the payment date. Here's the big issue for us. As of July 26, only about 13,000, it's 31 homes, were outstanding for their annual assessments, which is something we can collect. You know, it's normally a friendly reminder. You move forward from that. But we have about 100,000 that's tied up in roughly 8 households. And that goes back to fines, non-payment over multiple years, et cetera. And most of those, unfortunately, have had to go into some form of litigation or collection. And in some cases, that's a long-term process because of the personal issues with the homeowner. So that's a goal, is to obviously reduce that, but that's also a challenge, I think, for, you know, for the board going forward.
What specific efforts are being made to collect?
Yeah, there's a notification and collection process, Pete, that we go through. Basically, through a collection unit of Luter, Larkin, and Hunter, the legal firm, legal counsel for the Homeowners Association. There's a trigger point where you get into trying to settle via negotiated, you know, settlement, payment plans, et cetera. If that's unsuccessful, then it goes, generally speaking, it'll go into some type of legal step.
The reason I asked the question is, having been on the board in Florida, we ran into this, obviously, in the downturn.
Sure,
We used small claims court.
Interesting.
Which was incredibly successful.
Interesting.
Particularly when weighed against the legal costs. We actually used the master property manager to do it, and our success rate was about 92%.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, because at some point, the person being filed against has to provide financials and they don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So they pay up instead.
Yeah, interesting.
No,
that's a good. It's an excellent recommendation. Not to say it hasn't been tried, but I'm not aware that it has been. It's a good suggestion for me. I'll take it back. I got to talk to Luter Larkin or John Luter on Monday. I'll bring that up. Well, I know, but we're trying to get away. Well, we're trying to get away from that anyway as much as we can. We talked about POA, HOA. You know what are the benefits, and that's something going forward. We'll.
I have one other question. About
please.
Earlier. If I could, I'll please. Please. You have reserves. Right at or just over $1 million. That's an awful lot. To not have any more major structures than you do in this development other than entrances. Why so much? Based on your operating budget, that's almost 2 years.
Yeah.
And it's not as if you have to replace roofs or something like that.
Well, right. It's not like a condo situation, right? Right. Yeah. It goes back, one, to the flags that were raised 2009, 10, I guess, if I remember correctly, Pete, around surface water, ultimately a settlement, and quite frankly, still what is considered to be an open item with Forsyth County. Forsyth County will not assume responsibility for any of the surface water damage. Basically, their rule is that it's homeowner association responsibility. Our homeowners, the homeowner and the covenants clearly call out that it's homeowner responsibility. But there was a settlement that was made in court of roughly $300,000 because of some surface water damage. There are at least two other areas where I think that something like that could reoccur. So we're monitoring that situation very closely. We want to try to avoid, you know, one, avoid any damage and mitigate or at least improve.
Will those reserves be lessened once that comes to?
It's a good question. We haven't tackled that one yet. We haven't gone through a full risk assessment. We've got a dated infrastructure risk assessment, Pete, that needs to be updated, I think, before we really make that decision. But that's sort of the thought process at this stage, anyway. We've got one issue that's on the horizon that will require a lot of money for a fix, and we've got to deal with that probably in the next 30 days. And so what I'm telling you now could change very quickly. Again, transparency. Okay, so initiatives. And the spend. I'm running close to time here. Some of the key things that we've undertaken, the board elected to attempt changes in design standards to improve ability to enforce some issues that had been brought up through a lot of town hall meetings that we had and input from residents. I'll give you an example. Hopefully not affecting anybody in this room, but I'll give you an example. We have homes, not one, but homes, where there are at least three or up to six vehicles parked on concrete drive pads that have been there anywhere from 3 to 10 years, I'm told, in one situation. These are non-operational vehicles. These are vehicles that have not been registered. Some of them are pretty sweet cars, by the way. They're classics, but they haven't been registered, etc. We've got a lot of neighbors that complain about that. Well, they should be moved. Well, you know, quite frankly, right of use of property prevents, and our current covenants prevents that. So that's an example. There are about 10 items like that where you can't really enhance the community or address some of those unless you either look toward design standard changes or covenant changes. In our case, we elected to go design standards first, some of it for a learning process, to really bubble up the things that could be changed without rewriting the covenants and things that we could implement today. And we have a revision that would be published next week, I believe, on as a result of the process that we went through. But that did clearly point out through 159 edits from the attorneys to what we were proposing, it did point out that covenants have to be changed if we really want to improve design standards and, quite frankly, improve and enhance the neighborhood. And let me, again, just explain to a little bit about that. The covenants were written in the early 80s, basically for developer. They were never really transitioned to homeowner-directed covenants or homeowner-directed HOA. So 50% plus of your covenants are all related to development and construction, not to what is a fully developed community. So some way we have to get to the recognition of what we are today and have covenants that really address, you know, the issues that we have today. The second part of that is consideration of a POA versus HOA, and I'm just getting into that. There are, I guess, pros and cons for both. But that's another part of the assessment going forward. We've learned through the design standards. The next step is to begin to address the wish list of changes to the covenants that were brought out through that process and through other inputs from the residents. Hopefully I'm not boring everybody with this, but it does help for you to be informed, because that's a big issue. Getting covenants changed in a community of 1,060 home owners is a big issue, because you have to have a quorum to make any changes, and we have to go through a very lengthy process of educating each and every homeowner as to why the changes were made and what they include.
What's POA?
It's basically a property owners association, which gives more. It avoids some of the legal cost when you need to take action for violations. Would be one advantage potentially, but at the same time there are a number of other, as I understand it, a number of other issues that are a number of benefits of a POA. Keith?
Isn't there oversight by the state, too, that
yep.
is complicated?
Yeah, there is some. You have to deal with that. It's true. So there are pros and cons, but we'll have to educate ourselves as well as the residents on all the differences, pros and cons of each. All that said, we've ask the property management company to increase their inspections and be a bit more aggressive in the enforcement. They came back to us saying we need to have better guidelines through the design standards to really do a better job. And I think we've reached a compromise on that, so that we can address some of the things today that are annoying complaints from residents. But ultimately, we have to address the covenants. Capital investments, we, again, went through an assessment of, at least preliminarily, some major items, irrigation system, monument signage, Polo Outdoors, which is considered to be an amenity. I don't know how many of you folks actually utilize Polo Outdoors, but I was surprised, because I don't utilize Polo Outdoors, but there are a lot of people that do utilize Polo Outdoors, and it had not been addressed, quite frankly, as an amenity in the last number of years. Tree removal, overgrowth, combination of safety, visibility, appearance, all that has to be addressed. So we have irrigation system. For the most part, it's been totally updated. We had controllers that go back to 1985, 83, 85 that had to be replaced. It was a mess. So we've upgraded, repaired, replaced. We've gone to conservation system, and over time we'll transition the legacy systems throughout to low-volume irrigation, sequencing irrigation, so that we can get more bang for the buck for the water bill, the water consumption. The landscape monuments, we've refreshed all those, built the seasonal beds back up, repaired monuments where needed. We've got the trees and removal, et cetera. There are a number of overgrowth situations. Westchester signage is one where the cypress trees have actually grown into the stone monuments, things like that that have to be cleaned up. And that's throughout intersection. John, I think, or someone had pointed out in one of the recent homeowners meetings that the intersection club, Polo Club Drive and Lancaster, is sort of a blind corner. The trees and the shrubs and everything need to be cut back so that we make sure that no one hits an ATV or a golf cart with kids, around the corner. Well, as it turns out, when I start getting into this, we've got an easement issue. Who owns that property? Is it ours? Is it common property or not? We've just come off a full review of easements, and quite frankly, we still have two properties in here that are actually assigned to Fair Green Capital, not to Club Corp and not to the Homeowners Association on any type of landscape easements. So my point is, each time we've addressed or started to address an issue, we uncover something else that has to be addressed. Now, should we address those? We think we should. Let's get a clean slate for the next group that comes in, next board, next ACC, et cetera. Let's try to get things to something that the homeowners truly can buy into and understand that there are updated guidelines in place that should be the roadmap that's used for decisions going forward, or processes and procedures, ACC approvals, et cetera.
What's the status of the four-story mini warehouse going in behind Waterbury Way? Because my neighbor there, Lou Lewis, his living room looks right over there to that.
Yeah. The last I heard, it's a good question. The last I heard, the family-owned business that had purchased that property had modified the plans to make it basically a two-story facility. A lot of screening, a lot of mature trees to go in, et cetera, a lot of the stuff that was asked for, and more by the public hearings that were held for that one. But the last time I talked with Todd Levent, Todd felt that the lack of following the legal steps, the developer and attorney Ethan Underwood for his client, basically said that it could be shut down and no storage facility built. I heard this week through a second party, I haven't talked to Todd, that I guess Ethan Underwood has come up with some counter argument to that legal. So I thought as of roughly 2 weeks ago it was shut down totally. But the sign's still there for zoning. We've got there's 35, 36 stipulations that are built in for the zoning. And Keith may be able to tell us more. I don't know if you've been bought into it at all yet or not. My understanding is, all those stipulations are standing, that if it were to go forward, there are a lot of strong stipulations. But the fight right now is to continue not to build, but to shut it down totally. So I think it's probably 50-50 at this stage, John. I think it's going to end up in court. Initially, Todd felt that it was a good argument against the developer, but not a bulletproof argument. So, your guess is as good as mine at this stage. I'll be glad to follow up on that for you, because I need to try to find out what's happened recently. Obstacles and issues. This has probably been one of the most frustrating parts of the effort that we've made recently and from the board. GDOT, Bethel View, entrance, exit, it's a mess. We've tried to get there are, I think, varying opinions of what the ultimate finished product is going to look like. It's going to be a multiple step process to try to get into turn lane and go go north toward Kelly Mill. I think there's some significant risk and danger for residents in making that exit move. Even near term, the way it's designed, the elevation will require something in the range of about a 2.5 feet rise in elevation for the for Polo Fields Parkway, which takes out potentially takes out the island and obviously makes for a lot of changes in the entrance area, which will affect at least the south side monument of ours relative to, will we have to elevate that? If you take a look at the little wall that surrounds, that basically the dirt would probably be at the top of that planter wall when everything is backfilled in there. But the safety issue is probably the key. We've challenged the county, challenged GDOT. The response has been it doesn't justify a traffic light, not based upon the traffic volume there, but based upon the fact that there are alternative entrances and exits for Polo. Polo, in other words, is not strapped to one or two entrance and exits like a lot of the other subdivisions. We have Majors Road, we have Pittman, we have Post. Well, try to get out on Post or try to get out of Pittman, and it's taking life in your own hands. But bottom line, that's the justification now, that there are alternative opportunities for our residents to have entry and exit. So we've got an issue with GDOT. One of the fellows on the zoning committee and I will be meeting with GDOT on either Tuesday or Wednesday of next week to try to make sure they understand that they have to preserve the trees, on Polo Fields Parkway. Yeah. There's a discussion roughly 30 days ago said the trees were coming out. Well, no. In any of the plans, the trees stay. And we have to make sure that, I don't know, we may all have to be e-blasting you guys to come up and free hug, for us when they start trying to come in to move the curbs and change the that entrance. Because it'll go back, the alterations will go back 440 feet from today's entrance. Goes back pretty much to the curve in Bethelview Polo Fields Parkway, where the speed monitoring sign is erected. That's where they'll start grading up for this new exit. So trees we have to protect. We're meeting, trying to make sure that they don't once again rip out all of our wiring, irrigation, etc., by having a conduit that we place under the street, under the new redesigned entry, to allow us to feed wiring and pipe for the irrigation on the opposite side, the south side. So that's the kind of stuff we're going through. Again, it's nickel and dime stuff, but there were not pre-existing stipulations other than with property owners. And in this case, it's an easement. It's not a property ownership situation on that entrance. So we didn't, the HOA really didn't have an awful lot of input on the front end. We have to take a more aggressive position with that, and we'll do that going forward on any of the developments.
Any discussion between us and Vickery about that Pittman intersection? Because you're right. I mean, that is one of the egresses from where we live over up on Polo Hill.
Yep.
Alternative, but you can't even begin to turn left out of there most times of the day now.
Yeah. I know of three residents that have already been involved in traffic, two residents involved in traffic accidents over there, and one near miss. We've applied to the county and state to take a look at that. Right now, it still falls within, I understand, the most recent study that was done that was done basically for the Bethelview, but affected all those entrances. So it did not, quote, justify. Now, with Northfield, if Northfield is approved, the community on Pittman, just beyond Arcanum, if that's approved, my understanding is there's a stronger argument. There's 120 homes or so that go in there. If that's approved, then there's a stronger argument for at least a temporary light for the Vickery Pittman intersection.
I just didn't know what GDOT's position was. So many people.
Right now, it says. I hate to say that. I mean, that's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
GDOT, Forsyth County. Forsyth County is an interesting county. The engineering department has really cost us a good bit of money. And let me explain. Majors Road Sidewalk Splash Project. Sounds good. Yeah, it's nice. Widened sidewalk, whole bit. You guys probably know everything that's been disrupted there. It's been pretty nasty. The construction took out the irrigation line that fed to one side of the Buckingham Circle side of that intersection, Buckingham Circle, Buckingham Place, Majors intersection. Our request was that, okay, let's just tap in, do a drill, tap in to the pre-existing PVC that crossed under Majors. It was an incorrect installation. Should never have crossed under Majors. But it was done when Majors was still a dirt road and that phase was being developed. Crossed under Majors, and we were told, no, we can't, we're not going to do it. We're not going to allow you to drill into the curb. New curb, you know, and we potentially might have to have a footprint in Majors Road for a period of time to get the equipment in to drill through, allow us to run the pipe, tap into existing infrastructure, and rock and roll. Can't do it. Only way you can do it, drop a new meter. $3,500 plus the associated cost for plumber out for backflow valve, yada, yada, yada. That's the kind of thing that's been a surprise for me, and the stuff that we've had to get involved in that's time-consuming. But also, we have to do it to protect our own best interests, you know, in the financial position of the community. But we're going to probably have associated with Majors Road between, I think we're going to get all the fencing repaired. It looks like that's going to work. But between disruption, we had lifetime warranted fixture lights from outdoor lights at all the entrances. Well, guess what? They ripped out those fixtures. Very expensive fixtures, by the way. They ripped out those fixtures, replaced them with used hot metal light fixtures. So all of our warranty information from outdoor lights on those entrances where they're disrupted immediately disappears. Replacement going back to get it back to the stage it was before is roughly $3,000. So that's the type of, you know, obstacle after obstacle that we've encountered. And again, somebody has to take a look at it and dig deeper into it and go to the meetings and make the phone calls and write the emails and document by phone, et cetera. Those are the things that have been the time sucker. So getting back to one of the questions that was asked earlier, 35 hours a week out of my 70-hour week is HOA-related. So it's a bit of a challenge. All right, I'll leave it at that. I'm at the time limit, so... if there are any questions, you know, certainly HOA related, certainly send them my way. Although I'm complaining a bit, I'm also very interested in, you know, any ways we can help or improve. So, you know, let me know. And I do appreciate Pete. I do appreciate that recommendation. That could be a fine for us. It's good.
Thank you. Great job, and what a great presentation and great skill that Gary has to apply to our community. One of the things that I have passion for as I get more mature is I want to be more active at the end of my phase than I am now, and not just kind of, you know, just kind of fade to black. And I think we all have a tremendous amount of expertise and experience and knowledge, know-how that we can apply in some ways. One of the things I'm doing is making myself available to mentor to the Alpharetta Technology Center, which is a number of incubators. Are you familiar with them?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Right.
And just to make myself available to the young men and women that are going through what we've gone through to help them shortcut some of the things that we've had to learn the hard way. And I would encourage you all to be thinking about that. How can we do that in a more orderly, disciplined way that I don't know how we can do that. Many years ago, my wife and I started something called a Polo Business Owners Fellowship, and the purpose of that was to try to get men and women, spouses, who are either have their companies or like to start a company or whatever, to get together and to share ideas and also to find a way to build a community. So whatever that may take its form as you have some ideas, you know, maybe contact Gary. What's that website that people kind of network on, the Polo? Nextdoor. Yeah, Nextdoor. Yeah, and I'm not involved in that. My wife does. But something like that to get ideas. No, not good. Okay.
Can I make a suggestion?
Sure.
I just had a bad experience with it, and I don't recommend it. I'm a proponent of social media, and I think there's a lot of ways to use it correctly and stay connected. What we're trying to do, I didn't show the slides, what we're trying to do with a new website for Polo, which will have a soft launch at the end of this month, actually the next board meeting on the 30th. We're trying to create an internal next door, if you will. So if there are beefs and gripes, et cetera, that we keep those a little closer to home, you know, so that we can appropriately respond. If it's very specific. Not that, you know, we want to build a barricade around any of that, but some of the stuff that gets out, quite frankly, it's not positive for the
right.
community, nor is it even neutral for the community. So at least to have some, at least an option
yeah.
available as the goal. Honestly.
Good,
and so
good.
And that, I would say, is also the way to get at what you're saying. With let's say, 2,200 adults plus in this community, most of them very successful in their own way, many of them having time available, we should be able to identify skill sets, expertise, interests in a more organized fashion so that we can assist, you know, neighbors when they need assistance, but also draw on that expertise and apply it within the community and for others outside the community that we're aware of. So I'm hoping we can do a better job of that through the website.
Awesome. And it's hard to do. You know, we all are busy, and you know, we've lived here since 95, and we don't know our neighbors as well as we'd like to know them, and yet we're not sure exactly how to, you know, how to open the doors for that. I was thinking maybe there ought to be not for me. That's a unique giftedness that you have, Gary, that I don't have. But Germans are not very good consensus builders. Those of you who know other Germans. But anyway, thank you so much for coming. Invite your neighbors and. Have you a cup of coffee and hope to see you the one in, what's this, August, so September. Great, thank you.